You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and I'm here today on Bookworm with Tim Cahill, a guest again, with his book Road Fever, a high-speed travelogue recently published by Random House. So around a year and a half ago, Tim, you were on the road for 23 days straight doing what?
I was driving from the very tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, to the frozen northern edge of Alaska at the Beaufort Sea, Prudhoe Bay. Took the Pan-American Highway, the longest highway in the world, and in some cases the roughest highway in the world. And for reasons that have yet to be fully explained, we did it, my partner Gary Sorby and I did it faster than anyone else had ever done it. And are, in fact, in the Guinness Book of World Records for this rather dubious feat.
You, in the course of writing about this, it seems to me that traveling that fast, you'd be writing about what you didn't see.
Yeah, and that's one of the misconceptions of what this book is about. In setting up any kind of an event like this, what goes into it is often a lot more interesting than the actual event itself. So there was a year and a half of setting it up. Now, for instance, you know, there's a boom in travel writing now, and you see all the new travel books out, and the publishers have travel series. And you open up the book, and, you know, here's somebody who's traveled to Yemen, and here's somebody in Bali writing something. And the question, since this is my job to go out there and do it, one of the technical questions that always devils me is, where did I get the money for this?
Uh-huh.
and that's what I always want to know. Among the people that do this kind of traveling and adventuring for a living, it's a secret that nobody tells. It's like D.H. Lawrence said about sex, it's our dirty little secret. And I thought it was time somebody told that dirty little secret. So part of this book, part of the event is involved in raising money. We raised $350,000 to do something that I wanted to do anyway. Then the question is, well, yeah, but you've always wanted to drive all the way through South America, but you didn't get to see much. We had to go to each of those countries ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we visited 13, 14 different countries, scouting out the roads, making as high-level contacts as we possibly could, seeing what the border situations were, the terrorist situations, the ambush situations, and those kinds of things. So we really got to know those countries pretty well. And having scouted them, then we were able to make this drive. The drive itself was interesting in that you started at the end of winter at the very tip of South America, drove through springtime, got into the summer of tropics, hit the United States in, this was in October, so we hit the United States in fall, and in Canada it was winter, and then in Alaska it was just really the beginning of winter there. So we went through four pretty major seasons in less than 24 days.
Your partner in this trip, Gary Sowerby, has a family up in Canada. You are basically rootless except for your home in Montana. What keeps you from being a wandering buck all the time?
What keeps me from wandering all the time?
Uh-huh.
I do wander all the time. That's what I do for a living.
When does the writing come in? You don't write on the road, do you?
No, not much, no. No, I take my notes, and if I do write on the road, it's a I have to hole up and, you know, kind of find some place that I can stay for a length of time and do that.
You're a kind of hipster aesthete in terms of travel writing. And I wondered, you know, you mentioned a couple of weeks ago in a book review you did that nowadays more and more travelers are taking writers along with them to tell the tale. I wondered first if you'd tell me what the things you most hate in typical travel writing are.
Well, one of the things I really dislike, there are certain good travel writers. V.S. Naipaul comes to mind. They are people who you get the sense that they are writers first, and that what moves them to write well is the traveling and encountering different obstacles and different cultures, and that is the thing that moves them creatively. The reason that they travel is because they have to write. There are other kinds of people who have to travel, and they write to support that habit. And somehow, with those types of travel writers, I often feel cheated. In other words, they've gone out and had the experience that they wanted to have. They've traveled, and now they're doing the auxiliary thing. They have to write to do it. So in essence, some of those books read to me like your friend's videotapes of their vacation in Hawaii. I mean, it might have been really a lot of fun for them, but those tapes are amateurish and not well done. So I think what I resent in some of the new batch of books is, yes, you'll have someone who travels very well, but who doesn't do it for the writing. If you're going to buy a book, you buy it for the writing. You don't buy it to support somebody else's travel habit.
Absolutely. I was thinking, though, about, you know, in novels, we have Snoopy's famous opening, "It was a dark and stormy night." I wondered if Tim Cahill, author most recently of Fever Dreams, would improvise a horrible travel passage.
Let's see. As the plane dipped low over Sierra La Verde, I watched the green fields spread out like a blanket beneath me. You just know when they start with the plane coming in that you're going to get the person hasn't thought about this a whole lot. They're going to do it chronologically. And who cares what it was like when the plane drops into, Sierra Verde or wherever they're writing about. That's one of the dead giveaways. The square fields stretching away forever on the horizon, you know.
It's funny. I just called the book Fever Dreams, and in fact, it's called Road Fever. I guess I'm calling it Fever Dreams because so much of this trip, this 23-day trip from the tip of Tierra del Fuego to the Arctic, is involved in a kind of personal hallucination. I love the scene in which you see your driving partner in a lobby of a hotel, and neither of you can quite recognize each other for the normal and upstanding people you once were.
Yes.
Can you describe the hardships of this particular trip? I guess begin with those milkshakes.
Well, I suppose one of the major... Somebody once asked me, well, what was the best meal you had on this drive and the worst? And I said, best and worst were one and the same. We had thought that we could have freeze-dried food. Now, I'm a person who likes to eat, and I'm a person who likes to try the local food. But some of the food in South America is terrific. Chilean seafood, for instance, is just among the best in the world. But since we were in the process of setting a record, we decided not to eat local food, just in the off chance that somebody might get sick. What we would do is have freeze-dried food, make it in the car, turkey tetrazzini at 70 miles an hour, take one of those heating elements and plug it into the cigarette lighter and heat up. Well, that works fine for a cup of tea. 8 ounces, it'll heat it up right away. It won't heat up a quart. It takes about 20, 30 minutes. Now, I guarantee you, if you're holding a quart pan of water on your lap with a heating element in it and driving through South America, you're going to hit a bump. And that bump is going to spill that water in your lap. This is more than annoying. I mean, this could prevent your genes from being passed down to future generations. And so we found that we could not make the freeze-dried food that we thought we were going to make. I did have boxes of beef jerky we brought along for snacks. The other thing that we had was one of the sponsors for this trip was Farmer's Milkshakes, a Canadian dairy that makes milkshakes that come in little boxes that don't need to be refrigerated and have a 9-month shelf life. They thought, this would be a terrific idea. We would take these milkshakes, you know, from the Antarctic through the Arctic, Farmer's Milkshakes, the quality never changes. So we had 1,000 of these. So food consisted of coffee, a milkshake, and beef jerky. And we had, and that might sound a little boring, but I hasten to tell you that we had chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla milkshakes. So there were quite a variety for us.
Well, you know, some of those scenes in the book, because much of this driving depends upon being able to negotiate obstacles. That's what seems to be what this kind of long-range drive is about, whether it's terrorists or closed highways, and in some cases the throngs of children who gather around desperate scenes. So you are kind of like Korean War people handing out milkshakes to local kids who are always, you know.
Yeah, they always took the milkshakes. The milkshakes were, excuse me, also lapel pins. We had, my partner Gary Sarby is of the opinion that no person on the face of the earth does not want a lapel pin. And lapel pins south of the border tend, for the most part, to be light, cheap plastic that have been spray painted. But if you have a heavy metal lapel pin of good high quality, with good high quality enamel on it, those are treasured. And people ask how many bribes we paid on this, and there were situations in which I thought that a bribe might be in order, and in almost all occasions, the gift of a handful of high-quality lapel pins was enough to send us on our way.
Well, we found that at KCRW, too. You know, one of the most popular premiums when we have our fundraising drive is what we call our museum-quality lapel pin. Uh-huh. And it is always eagerly accepted by the natives.
I think it works really well. We call it pin money.
Uh-huh.
In those situations, you know, when you're going through a border crossing situation, you know when the bribe situation is beginning. What happens is the official almost always is really just doing his job to begin with. He wants to see if you're some kind of criminal, if you're stealing something, if you're smuggling something, if you're a danger to the country. Once he sees that you're okay and you're legitimate and your documents are in order, that's when he begins thinking, I wonder if I should shake this guy down for a little bit. You know, and what they can do at that point is decide to make your life just as hard and miserable as they can for as long as they can until you pay them to stop doing it, preferably in American dollars. This is the point in the police stop or the document check that you stop answering yes, sir, no, sir, with your hands in the air. Now they know that you're not a criminal and you're not going to shoot them. What you do is, at this point, is you start the jokes and the laughing. And
the lapel pins.
And the lapel pins. And they come out later. I mean, we had a whole act. You know, we try to find the guy that was in charge. He's making up his mind whether, you know, he's going to try to stick you and how much you might be worth. And you start saying things like, look what it says on the truck, Argentina to Alaska in 25 days. Hey, you want to come along with us? And you point to the guy in charge. And then all his underlings laugh because that means that they would be, and they all say, yeah, go along with him, go along with him. And then he says, yeah, maybe I will come along with you because, you know, as if he doesn't want to hang around with the, you know, these guys anymore. So you start getting him laughing that way. And meanwhile, my partner, Gary Sorby, who has the unique occupation of being, I think, probably the world's only professional endurance driver, holds two records, Guinness Book of Records, one for driving around the world, one for driving the tip of Africa to the most northerly point in Europe. And then we get out the Guinness Book of Records in Spanish and show these guys this thing. And then we start doing what I originally thought was a little bit of cant. You know, I would say, you know, here we are, just two guys. You know, we're not particularly rich. We both live in small little things. We have a dream, and our dream is to drive the tip of the Americas. You know what this Pan-American Highway is? It's a ribbon of friendship. It's a ribbon of unity. It ties all the Americas together. It ties our dream together, and you're part of our dream, and you can help us. And here's a handful of pins.
And, yes, and, there's nothing you can say to that.
Yeah. And almost invariably, that sort of act at the border things and at the police stops got us through just about everything. And I should add that in Colombia, we were stopped at gunpoint 21 separate times. I'm not talking about just your border stops or your police checks. I'm talking about, you know, men in cars with rifles bristling out the window who pull you over, you know, cut you off and pull you over, and then you have to get out on some foggy mountaintop in the night with your hands in the air and then answer questions, me and my bad Spanish, which I speak painfully one word at a time, all in the present tense, like Tarzan. Yeah. We eat much food now.
I'm talking to Tim Cahill, author most recently of Road Fever, gonzo journalist and adventure writer. One of the things that charmed me most in the book was the sections of a couple of chapters about the people from the Guinness Book of World Records. You went to them early on trying to determine what would constitute a record in this area, and learned in the process the kinds of things that the Guinness people will and won't accept as records. Could you tell a little about that?
Sure. Since it was our idea to drive this Pan-American Highway and set a record, the only institution the most credible institution to certify the record would be the Guinness Book of World Records. So we went to London to discuss this matter and find out what the rules were. I mean, it wouldn't make much sense to go and put all this effort and reconnaissance into it and break some silly rule that we didn't know about. So we wanted to know what the rules were. And as we're talking to them, they said, yes, this would be a Guinness Book of Records sort of thing. The duration driving records would be from geographic point to geographic point. They wouldn't accept a record, say, of someone who drove from Reading to Coalinga. you know, there's no specific geographic point there. They wouldn't accept the fastest Cleveland to Detroit run. They wouldn't accept, you know, a run from my apartment to my girlfriend's house. It's got to be from the tip of South America, where the sea begins, to Prudhoe Bay, where the other sea begins on that road. And so that was one of the rules. They did not want us to. They are very careful that the rules do not require you to break laws. And the editor was adamant there about certain records that he knew about, but would not publish. For instance, the world's youngest mother.
I particularly like that. It seemed very sweet that they would not want to encourage breaking that record.
Yeah, yeah. And it, so, yes, that. And there were certain other records that he'd just turned down as I was talking to him. Somebody said somebody wrote from America and wanted to see how many grapes he could stuff into his mouth. And, I mean, there's. If you look at that book, there are a number of hilarious records: cucumber slicing, eating baked beans with a cocktail stick, prolonged sermonizing, billiard table jumping. But one thing I noticed is one guy that holds what I thought was a really kind of silly record was prolonged clapping, and he clapped for about 3 days, and record calls for the hands to be brought together at least once every 20 seconds, I believe, and that the clap should be audible at 50 yards. And this guy did this for 3 days straight. And he was somebody from India, this small town in India. And as I'm going through there, I find another guy from India. And he's got he stood on his leg for 3 days, stood on one leg for 3 days. The rules there say that you can't rest your other leg on anything, not even your standing foot. You just got to stand there on this one leg. And I looked at it and I said, wait a minute, he's from the same small town in India. He could have hired his neighbor to give him a hand for a couple of days.
I want to get back to the question about writing. Wordsworth, pardon me here, said that that poetry was the recollection of strong emotions and tranquility. Now, this high-speed travelogue, Road Fever, certainly is a similar kind of recollection, as is all nature or travel writing. You said that you had your own version of this.
Yeah, I'll take Wordsworth one other in describing adventure is extreme fear or discomfort recollected in tranquility. An adventure hardly ever seems an adventure while it's happening to you. It's only when you stop and think about it and you say, "Huh, that was an adventure." Yeah.
Well, you've been. At the bottom of caves, and I think your career began with at least the first book publication. It was a biography of the mass murderer of boys, Gacy.
Yeah.
And you kind of entered the imperiled mind. What is coming up in the future?
The next book I hope will come about is it's. It's another adventure it'll be an adventure book with, I hope, a really serious value and import to it. In the northern part of the country, of the African country of the Congo, there is a large area of rainforest that is virtually untouched. It's been surrounded by swamps, and there's endemic diseases there. People don't live there. It is the one part of Africa that's been virtually untouched throughout the history of man. The World Bank, which has not always been a great friend of the environment, especially in the Amazon, took so much heat for what they were doing in the Amazon that they have suddenly become a friend of the environment. And they are tying millions of dollars of loans to the Congo into the creation of a national park that would encompass that particular area. It would also be a world park, and then it would encompass two other countries as well, Cameroon and the Central African Republic. So what you would have is the largest area of contiguous protected rainforest in the world. Mm. Now, there's an ethnobiologist that I know who is funded by the World Wildlife Fund, who is going to make a trek through that area to inventory the animals, and a Congolese who is going in there to identify areas of extreme interest in the park for you know, future treks in the park. What I'm looking at is something really quite similar to what the first parties that went into Yellowstone were doing in, say, the 1870s. They're looking at this this new park. It's also been demonstrated the president of the Congo will work with people who are interested in conservation, especially when those issues are well publicized. And I think that's my next project.
Publicity becomes an unfortunate thing sometimes, that you've been able to keep yourself as untouched as you can be. From projects that require sponsors, and in fact you did none of the promotional stuff that GM asked for in the course of this particular travelogue.
Well, you really can't write about something honestly if I mean, if GMC was paying me to write this book, who would believe what I had to say about GMC, and then by extension, anything else? It would have been exceedingly stupid of me to have accepted any money from GMC. It would have ruined any credibility that I had as a journalist from here on out. And that's the way I make my living. So it wasn't very hard to turn down money from GMC. I have the unfortunate problem of when people ask me whether the truck made it all the way, this thing, I have the unfortunate problem of the fact that I have to tell the truth, and the truth hurts because the truck didn't break down at all. So it makes it sound like I'm, lauding this truck. But I told them I'd tell the truth, and the truck worked just fine.
Tim Cahill has the great advantage as a travel writer of being not only believable but funny, and the stay-at-home like me, a mere bookworm, recommends highly books like Road Fever by Tim Cahill, my guest today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.